You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force.
President Obama addresses the UN General Assembly as airstrikes against Islamic State targets inside Syria continue. I'll be joined by the journalist George Brock and the former diplomat Jim Hoare to discuss that and the rest of the day's key news stories from around the world. Also ahead, when is it okay to make a private conversation public, as British Prime Minister David Cameron claims that the Queen purred at the news that Scottish voters had rejected independence from the UK in last week's poll. And a little later in the programme, we'll meet the curator behind a new exhibition that unpicks the rich history between photography and architecture.
The exhibition was curated to explore the relationship between architecture and photography and look at how artists and photographers respond to the built environment in their work, to say something about how we live, to say something about society.
Plus, we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and we'll assess how the humble art of baking became a global TV franchise in our weekly television review. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy 60 minutes in prospect then. Before we start, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. A video has been released online which appears to show the murder of a French tourist who was being held hostage by Islamist militants in Algeria. They had threatened to kill Hervé Goudel unless France halted its role in airstrikes in Iraq. He was seized in the northeast of Algeria at the weekend. Meanwhile, a vigil's being held tonight for a British man being held by Islamic State. Alan Henning was kidnapped last December while delivering aid in Syria. His brother-in-law, Colin Livesey, fears further airstrikes could lead to his murder.
It scares me. If they're going to do airstrikes on them, they'll just run away and they'll take him with him and no one will know where he is again. They might have a fair idea where he might be now, but by the time he gets to where he was, they might have moved him to somewhere else. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. I'm just hoping it will, but I can't see anything changing while they're airstriking.
The latest video emerged as President Obama told the United Nations that the world must act to dismantle Islamic State, calling it a network of death. He was speaking at the UN General Assembly in New York as US airstrikes continued to target militants in both Iraq and Syria. Mr. Obama said Muslim nations had a specific duty to stand up to extremists.
It is time for the world, especially Muslim communities, to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIL. No children are born hating, and no children anywhere should be educated to hate other people.
U.S. officials say they believe the leader of a group with links to Al-Qaeda was killed in American airstrikes over Syria. Mohsin Al-Fadil led Khorasan, a group described by the U.S. as an immediate threat to the West. Mark Pierini is a former EU ambassador to Syria.
The combination of sophisticated techniques that Al-Fadli might have brought with him, plus the training facilities of al-Nusra, plus the crossing of the border, is an extremely dangerous combination.
A new report is warning the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could spiral into a political crisis, undoing efforts to stabilize countries across the region. The International Crisis Group think tank warns that two of the three worst affected countries, Liberia and Sierra Leone, are still recovering from civil wars, while the third, Guinea, has faced a series of coups. Close to 3,000 people have already died from Ebola, with the UN warning infections could treble by November. NATO says there's been a significant withdrawal of Russian troops in the east of Ukraine, but it's also warned some forces remain there and Russian soldiers are still stationed nearby. Moscow has consistently denied sending its troops into eastern Ukraine. It's now 3 weeks since the imposition of a ceasefire between pro-government forces and pro-Russian rebels. More than 1,000 people have been arrested in Europe's biggest ever coordinated operation against organized crime. They're being held on suspicion of offences including people trafficking, drug smuggling and tax fraud. Cocaine, heroin and cannabis were seized and 30 Romanian children saved from trafficking. Rob Wainwright, who's the head of the international police organisation Europol, spoke earlier at a news conference in The Hague.
What we have seen emerging is an integrated underground criminal economy dependent on many different factors. So we have designed an operation specifically to hit that criminal infrastructure in many different of its parts of its key infrastructure, to hit it hard, hit it at the same time, so that we can magnify the impact that we have.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne. He'll be back with the headlines at the bottom of the hour. Right now it's 6 minutes past 18:00 here in London. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, това е Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Joining me here in the studio today are George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University here in London, and Jim Hoare, the UK's former Charge d'Affaires to North Korea. Welcome both to the programme.
No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force. So the United States of America will work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death.
That was President Obama's view on the fight against Islamic State fighters in Iraq and in Syria as he addressed the UN General Assembly in New York a little earlier today. Well, the coalition of US and Arab air forces continued their bombardment of targets inside Syria as world leaders gathered in New York, continuing to debate the operation against Islamic State. George, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. Obama definitely striking a tone there, talking about a moral case, not just reasserting sort of US leadership on this question, but making very much a moral case. Is that the right rhetoric from the President of the United States, do you think?
Well, I think it's better than his predecessor, who talked about the axis of evil. Now you've got the network of death. And actually, the network of death, apart from anything else, is a bit more accurate, I think, than the first phrase. And I think he was probably right to do it on a moral basis. I can't see much wrong with that. What, of course, he's not talking about in a speech like that, I mean, it's partly not the function of a speech of that kind, is to kind of acknowledge that what they're up to is an interesting empirical experiment in military tactics. You know, we've become much more used over the last decade or so to forces that don't want soldiers on the ground and getting killed and coming back in body bags, trying to do things from the air. And I suppose the fairest thing to say is we don't really know how much you can achieve militarily in what circumstances if you decide to do everything from 15,000 feet up. You know, it just tends to be a very inexact way of doing things. I'm not saying I know that it's necessarily going to fail. Obviously, ISIL is a large enough force that it has things like command centers, so there are targets they can hit. But whether or not just hitting them will actually produce the long-term result they want, or whether ISIL will just disperse into the population and make it extremely hard to hit them and do anything effective from the air, we don't yet know.
Jim, coming to you on that same point then, do you think that is a problem for the US and for its allies, this sort of loose coalition of Arab states involved? It's very difficult to know how to deal with the threat of the IS forces, and they are rather elusive. They're partly paramilitary, part terrorist. These groups are very difficult to pin down. And exactly as George said, to bring a traditional sort of traditional viewpoint to the kind of warfare that you're conducting, there's no guarantees it'll be effective.
I would agree with that. It seems to me highly likely that
you will have some successes. You will hit some of their command posts and maybe kill large numbers of them. But the basic organization is so fluid that, as George said, they will be able to mix with the local population. They'll be able to drift away. They're not sort of tied to any particular territory or any particular place. So you can bomb and you can bomb, and then you're bound to have the negative collateral that innocent people are killed, because some bombs, despite all the claims about accurate bombing, some bombs go astray. And that will happen in this case, as it's happened in every other one as well. And then what do you do? If the bombing doesn't succeed, if the Islamic State doesn't say, right, we give in, do you just carry on bombing, or do you actually put troops in? And I suspect eventually somebody will be putting troops in.
Well, let's talk a little bit about I mean, this could have an impact on exactly that point. We understand that UK Parliament will be recalled tomorrow, and it's likely that it would sanction UK action in Iraq, not Syria. The vote is expected to pass, should it occur tomorrow, as expected. What does that do, George, you think, for David Cameron, for politics in this country? Because the very much the shadow of the Syria vote from last year still looms large over this. Do you think this is the first steps towards, you know, what could be UK boots on the ground?
I would guess that the government will be extremely reluctant to put soldiers on the ground at this stage, knowing what we know now. I think they are perfectly well aware that public opinion is unlikely to have changed that radically. Yes, they may get the parliamentary vote. Not even that is certain until it's done, but I think they may well get it. But because people are much more frightened of ISIS than they were of what looked like a rather confused situation in Syria, when the vote looked like it was going to go against in Westminster. But I think that they will be extremely cautious about proceeding stage by stage. I don't think we want to necessarily assume that because air action is voted for, that amounts to MPs saying boots on the ground is going to be okay. I'm not sure one is a hint of the other.
It's interesting, Jim, isn't it? We started by talking about the sort of moral rhetoric that Obama had struck in New York today, and that the Iraqi Prime Minister has appealed to the UK very directly for help. Do you think there's a moral incentive for the United Kingdom to do more than it has done so far?
Oh, I think that's a very, very big and difficult question. I'm personally, and this is very much my personal feelings, I'm personally very wary of government interventions in most things. Motives are terribly mixed. Results are even more mixed. And as George says, I don't think the population in Britain, insofar as one can tell, is actually behind a great and detailed involvement in the Middle East, whatever the problems. Airstrikes, yes, okay, it's a long, small numbers of people actually involved, but actual fighting on the ground, I'm not sure that the people will be convinced of that.
I just wonder then, in terms of some of the other UK citizens who are swirled up in this problem, of course, some of these hostages who are still, on the ground, we think in Syria, possibly in Northern Iraq, likely Syria. Where does this leave them, George? We're hearing the news, the sort of brother of one of them saying that, you know, airstrikes, if they're given the go-ahead, make their fate even more uncertain than it is. Where do you think that any additional action sanctioned by the UK government would leave the hostages? Is it making their situation yet more precarious?
Well, I think they're in a bad place already, and obviously airstrikes is probably going to put them in a worse place. But it has to be said, don't forget, that British hostages were killed before any airstrikes, before Parliament was recalled, let alone airstrikes had been approved. So they weren't exactly in a very safe state earlier. But you can't say that their chances are going to get any better if airstrikes occur.
I just wonder, Jim, in terms of the view from the United States side of this, where do you think Barack Obama goes from here? He makes this moral case. He speaks with, great fluency, as he always does. Do you sense there's a similar degree of scepticism from, you know, on Capitol Hill and more broadly in the US about the US getting more involved here as well?
I suspect as it goes on, and I suspect it will go on, then you will find that people are not terribly happy about being dragged into another conflict, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, something that you can see no end to. And when you think you've got out of it, as they thought they'd got out of Iraq, you're dragged back in again. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Afghanistan didn't actually start causing some problems once the euphoria over the election is over. So I think in the United States that there is probably a weariness about the continued involvement with conflict in the Middle East, where each time you're promised it's finished, I mean, the number of times George Bush said it was all over, and it wasn't. I mean, that actually, I think, throws people.
Mm-hmm. And George, just on the point that the US has assembled this loose coalition of various sort of Arab states, Arab air forces who are involved, do you think that in itself is something of a positive note? Is that something to, if not celebrate, to at least mark a significant moment? The fact that you have some essentially Sunni governments who are willing to at least join in the US agreeing to airstrikes on Sunni militants. Is that a significant moment, do you think, for the region and internationally?
I don't think there's any question that the taking part by, I think it's five Gulf governments or in the military action is an extraordinary moment. They've never done anything like this before. Now, we're not hearing very many details about what they've been doing, which tells my cynical mind that they may not be doing that much. Nevertheless, as a symbol, it's still very, very important. And it's clearly the base. I mean, it's the basis on which the outside powers, Britain, France, and the United States, obviously, are rather hoping that if somebody says, right, this can only be achieved by doing something on the ground, they will say, well, it can only be done on the basis that we've done it already. You're going to have to come too. That would be a very difficult moment.
Mm. And where, Jim, does it leave Assad? We sort of sometimes forget about him, you know, across the border in Syria. Where's he left by this? Is he weakened? Is he strengthened somehow? What do you think that these combined airstrikes mean for him?
Well, I think he sees these people who are the subject of the airstrikes as his enemies. And if somebody else is going to do something to sort them out, that's to his advantage. But, of course, he is being excluded from the current coalition of the willing. And I think that in itself will have problems as time goes by. But exactly at the moment, he's sidelined, but he hasn't said this is wrong, although theoretically it's violating Syrian airspace. So I think he'll just sort of stand and watch for a bit longer.
Do you think he must necessarily be a part of any solution? Because obviously there's a great deal of unease. It's telling, I think, even when Obama talks about this, that he specifically says ISIL. You know, he tries not to sort of conflate the two issues. But is that short-sighted to imagine there's a way of dealing with this that doesn't involve even some form of discussion with Assad?
I would think eventually you would need to talk to the Syrian government on this.
There were some other interesting stories overnight, quite worrying scenes in Australia, where there was an incident of a shooting of a suspect who stabbed a couple of police officers. He was apparently being monitored for potential involvement with some kind of Islamic extremism, and he died as a result of his injuries. People are saying, look, this shows that the international spread of the kind of extremism we've seen, people travelling internationally to participate in the conflict in Syria and in northern Iraq. And it does seem that there are these almost new fronts springing up all around the world. Do you find, George, that that's of concern? Is it unhelpful to seek any way to tie these kind of things in together? Or do you think it is this broad question that we in the West simply haven't got very good at dealing with the threat of militant Islam?
I think you've got to be very, very careful about assuming that because there is a boiling piece of trouble in some part of the world and that people are attracted to it from your own country, that you can necessarily stop them or reduce their wish to come back and possibly commit atrocities on home soil, that you can deal with that by military intervention. I'm not sure that it always necessarily follows. It may be that we're going to look back on this phase and think that actually the only thing you can do in this situation is just make your counter-terrorist preparations as best you can and your protections as best you can. Actually intervening on the ground in the situation itself, where it is so complicated and it is so difficult to get the result you want without disproportionate risk or damage or cost, may be very hard to do. And I do actually think this is where the public is. I mean, if the public thought, prime ministers keep implying that you have to intervene in this situation in order to stop the risk or lower the risk of bombs going off at, in London. I don't think, actually, generalising wildly about British public opinion, I don't actually think the British public sees it like that. Because they say, OK, explain to me exactly how the cause and effect is supposed to work here. If you can explain that to me, then maybe I'll believe in it. But so far, I'm suspending judgment.
That's George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. Jim Hoare, the UK's former charge d'affaires to North Korea, is also alongside me. When we return after a short break, we'll assess what to expect from Asia's leaders at the UN General Assembly and ask whether it's ever OK to reveal the contents of a private conversation between a queen and her prime minister. Stay with us.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me here in Studio One are both George Brock and Jim Hoare. Let's return to the United Nations General Assembly now, a platform for leaders from around the world to address the pressing issues of the day. How will leaders in Asia use their moment at this year's gathering as they address audiences both at home and abroad? Jim, perhaps if I can start with you. Is it rather unfortunate, given the events we've already discussed in the programme and others, I'm thinking of, you know, Iran and Ebola, does it mean that whatever people say when they get their moment in the sun, that they're going to be rather overshadowed?
I suspect that might be the case. The fact is that a quick perusal of headlines in Asia didn't actually show up much at all about the UN today. The only exception to that was the North Koreans protesting, no, not quite protesting, but the United States called a meeting in the margins. It didn't call a UN meeting, but in the margins of the UN to discuss the UN report on human rights in North Korea. And the North Korean government, the foreign minister is there, and the ambassador, who used to be the ambassador in London, asked that they should attend. And didn't get a reply for a long, long time and was eventually told, no, you can't. This is a private meeting, which I think is a wasted opportunity. I mean, I think whatever you have to put up with listening to the North Koreans defending their position, at least you can, if you get them in the room, talk to them and they have to listen to you. So I think that was a missed opportunity. But everybody else has been quite silent so far on issues. I think for the Chinese, for example, the whole business of intervention, I mean, they don't like Islamic fundamentalism, they don't like extremism, but they equally do not like the idea of states going into other states and telling them what to do. So the Chinese, I think, are going to find themselves in a bit of a dilemma over this one. The Japanese, I don't know. There was nothing at all in the Japanese newspaper headlines that indicated any interest in the United Nations. Now, that said, the Japanese do take an interest in the United Nations. But Mr. Abe, the Prime Minister, has in the last few months sort of moved on the whole question of the involvement of Japanese military forces overseas. And I suspect that there are some in Japan who are just saying that if we keep our heads down, nobody might remember that or not ask us to get involved, because I don't think the Japanese would want to get involved in this particular one.
It's interesting you mentioned the idea of sort of missed opportunities, particularly with reference to this kind of high-level delegation from North Korea, what, 15 years, I think, since they last sent somebody to the UN General Assembly. George, why do you think that is? Do you think the view is that the UN General Assembly is not a useful forum, even though you can have, as Jim was saying there, these interesting sort of private, you know, bilaterals and trilaterals? that's not an opportunity people are willing to seize. Why do you think that is?
I think if I lived in Asia, I would be inclined to be very indifferent to the UN on the grounds that its structure and its decision-making powers don't really reflect Asia's general clout now. The UN was formed in an era in which forums for statecraft were essentially a Western thing, roughly speaking. And I think they are just a bit cautious and tentative about using their leverage in it because they think it tends to be a language and an environment wasn't really built for them, and they're not that familiar with. Although it's only words so far, the Chinese did say today that they were going to try and do more on climate change. If you think back to the Copenhagen summit, and they said this at the UN in New York, if you think back to the Copenhagen summit of some years ago, which broke down when they were attempting to get a climate settlement, that broke down essentially because the Chinese wrecked an American attempt to kind of set things because they wanted to teach the Americans a lesson. Now, unless I'm much mistaken, the Americans will have spent a lot of time in the intervening years saying to the Chinese, look, that didn't work. Be clear. We can't make you do anything, but spewing all this stuff out of coal-fired power stations and building, you know, several new ones every opening, new ones every week, isn't going to be very good, not only for you, but not for anybody else. And it's just possible that this rather bland set of words from the Chinese is the tip of an iceberg of effort, which a lot of countries have been putting into to say to the Chinese, look, if you don't help on this issue, we're in deep, deep trouble. You've got to do something about this.
A tip of an iceberg effort. I rather like that.
Actually, it's rather, as a matter of fact, it's rather an inappropriate image, actually.
Well, no, a melting ice. Exactly, yes, a melting ice with all of these fumes billowing around it. Jim, just a final thought on this. In terms of then meaningful developments, real achievements out of the UNGA, are we misguided to think that we might see anything really concrete and actually quite useful, or should we not be so cynical about it?
Oh dear, I've been cynical about the UN for years and years and years. It is essentially a place for people to strut their stuff and to go and perform. You don't, I think, get much done really in the big open debates or even the formal presentations. The Prime Minister's gone so that he can be seen to be the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. I don't think he's expecting to do much in real policy terms at the United Nations. I'd be surprised if he did, but as I say, I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's this year, because of the Middle East in particular, it's probably a bit more business, real business will be done than in many other cases. But frankly, it's the back rooms and the contacts that matter rather than the big public show.
Always want to be a fly on the wall in some of those bilaterals. A couple of minutes left at the end just for us to talk finally about, the dust settling on after last week's referendum here in the UK, Scottish independence. Of course, the no vote came through. We do seem apparently to know what the British head of state felt about this highly charged event. In an informal conversation with New York's former mayor Mike Bloomberg, British Prime Minister David Cameron suggested Queen Elizabeth purred with delight when he informed Her Majesty that Scottish voters had decided to stay part of the UK. Lots of raised eyebrows. George, what did you make of this? Are we making a fuss about nothing, or is this a serious matter of an abuse of protocol?
No, it's not a serious matter, for heaven's sake. People have been quoting the Queen out of, you know, but not strictly, if you like, with her permission for years and years and years. If Cameron had said, what she said to me was, no, actually, Prime Minister, I'm extremely cross. I've been dying to get rid of them. That would have been a story. Now, that would have been an event. But actually, what he quoted her as saying was more or less exactly what millions of people would have guessed she'd have said. Sorry, no big deal.
Jim, what about you? I mean, you sort of understand the diplomatic sort of nuances that we should observe. Do you detect a faux pas here?
I think it was a rather silly, boastful comment, really. Look how important I am. I've been talking to the Queen. I bet when he next meets the Queen that he should watch out for the long nails and the scratches. But I don't think it's terribly serious. I think it's a good bit of light relief for for the moment, but nothing much beyond that.
Before we go, there's a couple of my favourites of recent years when people were sort of overheard, abusing their position. Some might say Sarkozy and Obama talking about Benjamin Netanyahu back in the day, and Sarkozy supposedly suggesting, "I can't stand him, he's a liar. You're tired of him, what about me?" said Obama. Do you think this gets anywhere near that then? Or, I mean, do you think that a private conversation should remain private? George, you understand how journalism works. It's inevitable, isn't it, that when you have that sort of juicy detail, people of course want to talk about it in
more
detail.
If somebody gets caught out, there was a Polish foreign minister, in fact he got sacked or at least moved the other day, and people were speculating because he'd been extremely vituperatively critical of David Cameron in a conversation about Cameron's European policy. I mean, people, you know, gaps in people's care happen. Words seep out. Mostly, actually, if you look back, they tend to confirm things that people mostly guess. When it's dramatic, then it's different. But I don't think they change the course of events to an enormous one. I thought the one you were going to bring up was Bush's famous, that's to say George Bush's famous Yo Blair, when you actually read the transcript was fascinating, but absolutely to me incomprehensible. I did not know what they were talking about.
And there we must leave it. George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London, and Jim Hoare, the UK's former charge d'affaires to North Korea. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll check in with one of our correspondents, head behind the scenes of an exhibition that unpicks the relationship between photography and architecture, and...
Have you tried this before? Well,
yes, I've practised it. The big worry today is you're going to say this bread's underproved.
Find out how the humble art of baking became one of the hottest franchises in TV history. Before we get started on all that, though, let's catch up on the latest world news headlines. Here's Paul Osborne.
France has confirmed that an Algerian jihadist group with links to Islamic State has murdered a hostage. Tourist Elf Goudal was seized on Sunday, his captors demanding France halt its role in airstrikes in Iraq. The French President François Hollande says those strikes will continue. He's called the murder a cruel and cowardly act. The video was released as President Obama was speaking at the United Nations about the threat posed by Islamic State, calling on the world's leaders to unite and defeat the militants. And it's been announced the British Parliament will be recalled on Friday to discuss possible UK military involvement in strikes against IS. Elsewhere, NATO says it's seen evidence of a significant withdrawal of Russian troops in eastern Ukraine, but it's also said some Russian forces remain there. Moscow has denied sending troops into the area and insists it's not been arming pro-Russian rebels. And hundreds of students have marched through Hong Kong's financial centre on the third day of their protest demanding democratic reforms. They're angry after Beijing rejected calls for open elections to Hong Kong's next leader, insisting the candidates must be pre-approved. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne at the top of the hour. 1900 will be your next full bulletin here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio. That means it's time to talk to one of our correspondents around the world today. We're heading to Estonia and Monocle's contributor in the capital, Tallinn, Liz Kengsepp. Liz, great to speak to you as always. Let's talk about a story, a murky sounding story of abduction and mystery involving the Internal Security Service. Tell us a little bit more about this one.
Yes, it's a very, very complicated story. It happened about 2 weeks ago when an Estonian security officer who was actually on an operation very near the border, Estonian-Russian border, and Estonian government says that he was pretty much snatched by the Russians and taken back to Russia. And after that is we have very little information what happened to him. So we know that the FSB has a different side of the story. They say that he was actually in Russia when he was taken under custody because he was being suspected of espionage.
Now, I mean, there's a degree of concern about this, not only because it suggests, you know, that the border itself may be rather porous and rather unsafe, but let's not forget that this Estonian border is not just between Estonia and Russia, but the eastern border of NATO and the EU. Do you think that adds an extra sort of level of complexity still further?
I think it does. I think it does. And also what adds another thing for Estonians to this story is that this happened 2 days after President Obama was in Tallinn assuring us all that Article 5 will hold and that Estonia will never stand alone again. So I think Estonians are getting a little bit worried and a little bit nervous with the situation. And there's been a lot of fuss in local media about whether the border holds or not. So I personally think that probably it does hold quite well, because the police says that they were actually not guarding the border at that very moment when the event happened, because the internal security agency was conducting operation on the border.
And tell me, Alex, what's going to happen as a result? Will there be pressure on Prime Minister and his government to, you know, make changes to the border security? I believe they might have already been for an inspection. Do we know what they're going to do about it?
Yes, they've said that they are going to give more money to make the border better or make the border guard better. And they were there, the Prime Minister and the Minister for the Interior, they were at the very site where the abduction happened yesterday. They were there yesterday to have a look how the whole things are being organized. So I think they are working very much in order to make the border even better.
Now, Lise, tell me, to change the subject slightly, I wonder, are those sort of border areas of Estonia particularly good for foraging? Are there any good mushrooms available there?
Well, you know, I have a friend who has a summer house very near to the place where the abduction happened. And he's getting a little bit upset because he is a little bit worried that he cannot go and pick mushrooms anymore in the spots that he really likes, because it's a little bit too close to the border. So, yes, you can find a lot of mushrooms near the border.
And tell me about the Estonian, I mean, would I be right to describe it as an obsession with foraging for mushrooms? Because there's an incredible variety and people are often talking about sort of, you know, fungi when it comes to the Estonian countryside.
Yeah, I think people in Estonia are really obsessed with foraging. It's I've seen numerous posts on Facebook. Everybody's posting their mushroom pictures on Facebook. And I even have a few friends who have been asking for a filter to filter out all the mushroom pictures because they're so tired of seeing other people's mushrooms because they have to stay in an office and work and are not able to go to the forest to search for mushrooms.
Just finally, at least before we leave you, I don't know, maybe you're going to be off foraging yourself. It could be happening. Just talk to me a little bit about where the Estonian people get their information from, because I know that a lot of people still, you know, using Russian language TV. But tell us, I mean, will there be any changes, do you think, to the media landscape as well as to the mushroom landscape in Estonia?
The change in the media landscape has been decided as well, and it's been really, really widely discussed over this summer, especially after this spring events in Ukraine. So people are talking a lot about the necessity to have a Russian language TV channel that belongs to the state. It's a public broadcasting channel, because 25% of our population is Russians or Russian native speakers, which means that they mostly get their information from Russian TV channels. And what they get from Russian TV channels might not always be the objective picture of what actually is happening in the world. So the state has now decided to give money to start a new channel, and they are planning to start broadcasting next year in September.
We'll have to pay very close attention to that. Lise Kengsep in Tallinn, thank you very much for joining us. What an excellent roundup that was. We had media, we had mushrooms, we had hard news. Wonderful stuff. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll head behind the scenes of a new exhibition that examines the constructed world.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 1840 in London. Photography and architecture have always had a very strong connection. A new exhibition at the Barbican here in London called Constructing Worlds tries to depict this relationship, showing over 250 works from 18 leading photographers from the 20th and 21st century. From Bernice Abbott's pictures of rising skyscrapers in New York in the 1930s to the more contemporary work of Ivan Bahn. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the exhibition and spoke to its curators and two photographers whose work is in the show.
I'm here at the Barbican in London at the Constructing World, Photography and Architecture in the Modern Age. The curators of the exhibition are Elias Redstone and Alona Pardo.
The exhibition was curated to explore the relationship between architecture and photography, and more concisely than that, look at how artists and photographers respond to the built environment in their work, to say something about how we live, to say something about society, to use architecture as a protagonist through which to look at the world.
And Alona, how did you select all this material? Because, I mean, in this exhibition you cover such a long period, since the 30s until nowadays.
I think we were very clear early on that there were a number of narratives that we wanted to explore and subjects. One was that we wanted to tell a history of the subject, so therefore it meant having a historical breadth of material. But really what our starting point was that we wanted a lot of the work to feel very, when you looked at it, to feel very modern, to feel contemporary. We didn't want it to feel nostalgic or historical. So we start with Berenice Abbott very much, and when you look at her work, it could almost be, some of them could be taken today. They feel very of its moment, and that was because she was photographing in a way that was very direct, was very modern. And so that selective criteria continued. We know we wanted to tell a story that was a global journey, so we knew we wanted to open out from the US and Europe to tell a story that encompassed China, the export and appropriation of the international style in Africa and India. So there was all sorts of compelling factors to bring these particular 18 photographers together in a show to tell a kind of a meta-narrative of the story of photography and architecture through the 20th, 21st century.
And Eliza, I just have a question for you. We're talking about, you know, Nadav Kindar's pictures, which are impressive. But in a way, they're not typically like what would you call like a beautiful space in a city. But somehow it is beautiful. I mean, I wonder, how do they try to portray the beauty of a city in those pictures? Not only Nadav, but the other artists as well.
Well, I think the artists are not looking just to portray and document, but they're looking to seek out the symbolic value of architecture and the built environment. They're looking to, when it's a known architect, not just show the architect's intentions, but actually the lived experience. And for Nadav Kindar, he took several trips down the Yangtze River in China from the mouth to the source and looked at how the landscapes were changing as this whole country was modernizing itself. So what you see is these monumental infrastructural insertions into the landscape and how the people that live there are kind of responding. So you have these landscape photos with moments in them of change, of modernity, and the sublime images have this kind of like romantic glow, this haze that infiltrates them all. But this haze is there because it's pollution. It's the effects and change of an industrial country.
And Alona, I just want to talk about the setup as well, because, you know, the exhibition looks very pretty, and I wonder how did you thought about it, because, you know, I'm sure there's some architectural elements in between. I mean, can you tell us more a bit about this process? And it's also in chronological order?
It is. The exhibition is presented chronologically. And so there was already a kind of an organising principle or a guiding principle as to how the show could be laid out, could be thought about. But very early on in the process, we engaged the services of the Brussels-based architecture practice office, KGDVS, who we felt had a kind of great sensibility towards photography. And they've worked with a number of photographers in their practice, notably Baz Princeton, who's here. And we asked them to study very carefully the bodies of work, but also to respond to the architecture of the Barbican, and they came back with a very kind of bold and clear and sophisticated and elegant response, kind of looking and taking the shapes that are found within the kind of architectural language that's found within the photographs themselves and kind of exploring that into kind of three-dimensional architectural shapes in the gallery.
Present at the event, there were also some of the photographers featured in the show. First, we hear from Nadav Kander, followed by Ivan Ban.
Hi, my name is Nadav Kander. I photographed the Yangtze, the Long River. That was the title of the work in 2007 and 8. I made 5 trips to China, each one for about 10 days, 15 days. I traveled most of the length of the Yangtze, a river in China. I felt it, as an artist, really necessary to work in China at the time because it was a place moving and changing at such unrelenting pace that I wanted to feel what it was like to make work there. And I think the backstory to the work is obvious. I first get very attracted to a place for various reasons. I was very attracted to China for the reason I just told you. And once attracted, all I do is make the kind of work that nourishes me. I put my head down and I work for about 10 days at a time, never longer, because I start to become too local. And I make strong compositions that I believe quieten a viewer down. I like to think that there's much more communication in a picture than just the information they hold. I think if you think of other artists, for instance, Francis Bacon or Rothko, people that not necessarily had that much information on the canvas, but caused such reaction. And that's through the constructivism, the construction of a picture, the weight of a picture, the curve, a straight line, can tell you so much about yourself.
My name is Ivan Ban. I'm a photographer, and my work sort of always revolves around the built environment in different ways. Part of my work is commissioned works with the architects who built the most iconic structures these days, which fascinates me a lot. But at the same time, since I'm traveling so much, you run into so many very specific conditions on how people actually build things themselves without any architects and without any planners involved. And what I'm showing here in the exhibition is a series, the Torre David. It was a skyscraper, the second highest building in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. The building was finished, or like was built end 80s, early 90s, before the whole economy crashed in Venezuela. So the building was never finished. It was just a concrete shell in a way. And people started about 8-9 years ago, people started to invade that concrete shell and build basically a vertical city in there. So what you see here also is kind of a frame of concrete columns and staircases, no infrastructure, no elevators, no running water, electricity or so. But in the end, like 750 families, about 3,000 people who built their own houses and a whole city with like shops, hairdressers, the gym and everything sort of in there, like a real city, but yeah, in a 45-story walk-up.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there reporting from the Constructing Worlds exhibition at the Barbican here in London. Ticking towards the top of the hour here on Midori House, we're going to be talking television in a minute or two, but let's sample some art of a different kind. A new track from one of our Monocle 24 favourites is out very... I think it might even be out today, this track. It's Tuvalu, 1,000 Miles. That is Thousand Miles from Tuvalu. Queen of the Clouds is out today, the album. I'll wager that you're going to be hearing that track a fair bit over the next couple of weeks here on Monocle 24. It's Midori House. We're ticking towards the top of the hour, but time to talk television. Alliterative. I'm delighted to say joining me from The Telegraph is Alice Vincent, a television critic there. Alice, so great to have you on the programme.
Thank you.
As always. Now, we're going to be talking about the Bake Off phenomenon in just a moment. Before we talk about it, let's hear about it.
Oh. Is that your dough, Nancy?
That's my dough.
And I'm going to finish the first probe in the microwave.
Have you tried this before? Yes,
I've practiced it. The big worry today is you're going to say this bread's underproved.
Torna Bake Off Italia. I casting sono partiti.
È già una bella occasione essere qua.
Ho detto perché no.
Se mi casca è finita.
He's smart, determined, and he's got that geeky charm.
When I first started reading, the only thing I read was cookbooks.
He's Sydney's Big Bang Baker.
I love a challenge, and I especially like proving people wrong.
More pavlova than supernova.
My secret weapon is my lucky rolling pin.
My oh my.
Auch beim Käsekuchen Grand Prix wagt Daniel wieder ein außergewöhnliches Rezept. In seine Karamellcreme rührt er Kaffeepulver. Und für das Topping seiner Frischkäsemasse verwendet er Chips und Salzbrezeln.
Le meilleur pâtissier, la finale, c'est demain, à 20h50 sur M6.
That was La Meilleure Pâtissière from France, finishing off that report. It's amazing, Alice, isn't it? I mean, for the, what, a couple of people who are living in a cave somewhere who haven't sort of engaged with the Bake Off phenomenon, maybe just put it in some kind of context for us, where this show kind of came from, what it's done while it's been around.
Okay, so it's been around for 5 seasons now, and it's it started off small in on BBC Two, and it just took off. It's a baking competition. It's like X Factor for cakes, but everyone is incredibly nice.
And what do you think appeals to people? Is it because it connects with them? People like baking, or certainly sampling the products of baking. Why so successful? Because as you said, it had, one would imagine, fairly sort of modest ambitions at the outset.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is because in this world where there's so much cruel reality TV, it is purely pleasant. It's very nice, it's very friendly, and it's amazing what sort of dramas there can be in whether there is going to be a soggy bottom in a pie or not. That sounds hysterical, but no, it's really true. It's very, the characters, they know which people they're getting on, and it's just very nice. It's enjoyable viewing.
Now, I'm sure, given that your job, that people often ask you, well, you know, have you spotted the next thing that's going to be, you know, the hot franchise that goes all the way around the world? Would this have been one? I wonder, when you sort of watched the early days, do you think, I'm sure they can't wait in the Netherlands, Norway, you know, Denmark, Belgium, wherever it is?
No, I mean, it really got kind of panned by critics originally. People thought it was annoying or humourless. They didn't understand it. And it's been a real sleeper hit, you know. It's like that dough that eventually proved itself. It's no, not at all. But then, interestingly, Gogglebox, which is a similar sort of pleasant British phenomenon, has had a similar international interest as well.
Just pick up on what you said about sort of X Factor, but less harsh. Do you think we are reaching the sort of end days of those very judgmental, aggressive, you know, public participation programmes? Do you think people have said, look, actually, I want to see some people maybe being nice to each other?
The really interesting thing about X Factor this year is that they have really cut the nastiness out of it. And, you know, before it was like Simon Cowell being so unpleasant. And it's noticeable that a lot of the auditions are really pleasant now. And we just see the good people. There's none of that public slating. I think everyone's bored of it, yeah.
Let's move on, Alice, and talk about another contemporary phenomenon. I'm sure people with their mobile phones will be well aware of the idea of taking self-portraits. And this is making its way onto the small screen.
That's right. I gather that the word selfie is banned on Monocle Radio, but it is the name of Karen Gillan's new show. The pilot's coming out at the end of the month. And it is sort of a kind of contemporary My Fair Lady. This woman who went from geek girl to Instagram star realises that she's not a very nice individual and needs to change her ways.
Let's take a quick listen to a clip from this.
This is Henry Higgins. He's like totally boring, but he's a mad genius at his job and stuff. He took a product that caused satanic hallucinations and made it cool again. And now he's gonna totally My Fair Lady me too.
It recently came to my attention that I have poor instincts, a weak stomach, no real friends, and
loose sexual morals.
Have we met?
Eliza, I'm sure you're aware it is possible to be beautiful on the outside and still butt on the inside.
Like Gwyneth Paltrow.
That's the sound of Selfie. There, I'm going to get a slap on the wrist for that. What do we think? The next big hit, or maybe left to be desired?
I don't really like the look of it, but I think it's got very much the New Girl, Ugly Betty vibe about it, and that was riotously popular.
Now, as time is against us, we don't have long to talk about another selection, American Horror Story. Just tell us a little bit about this one briefly.
It's completely bonkers. It's very grisly. It's a horror anthology series from the creators of Glee, and if you like it, you'll be addicted, and if you don't, then you'll hate it.
I think that's a fairly good summary. What camp are you in?
I really like it. It's bonkers. You'll never see anything else like it, but I think it's very smart, and it's won a lot of awards for a reason.
Just as a final thought then, anything else coming up that you're very excited about, or do you think we've got plenty enough to be getting on with our international bake-offs, our horror stories and all this kind of thing?
It's autumn season, the nights are drawing in, there's plenty on. I mentioned it last time I was on, but I'm excited about Gotham.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's one we'll have to watch out for. Alice Vincent, TV critic for the UK's Telegraph newspaper. Thanks for joining us here in Midori House. And that is, sadly, all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks to my special guests earlier on the show, George Brock and Jim Hoare. And do stay tuned next. Daniel Giacopelli brings you this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, our show all about how to do great business. That's next. Don't forget, 2200, we've got the Monocle Daily as well. Emma and Andrew in the chairs for that one. And this programme, Midori House, will be back, as if you needed reminding, at exactly the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours here in London. But for this edition of the programme, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.